My name is Tone Hellesund, and I'm working here at the Rokkan Center, which is a research institute in Bergen, Norway. And we're about 50 researchers doing different kind of social research, and we're both from the social sciences and from the humanities. And I'm from the humanities myself, and I have a PhD in ethnology or cultural anthropology. And I'm interested in different kind of research around gender and sexuality, but also inclusion and exclusion, normalcy and difference, and those kinds of issues.
Okay, what has been the emphasis of your recent work, or the work that you consider the most significant to your practice?
Well, for me, all my research is connected to these interests, and my first research project, a big research project, was about spinsters in the area 1870 to 1940. And I look at the construction of the spinster as a category, and the construction of the spinster as queer or odd in a gender and sexuality way. So from the spinsters, I moved on to narratives about young homosexuals in contemporary Norway.
Could you explain before you move on the idea of the spinster?
Yes. So the single women in the period 1870 to 1940 were constructed as a social problem. What to do about these single women? Why didn't they get married, and what should society do about them? And how would this change society? And of course, this was also in a period where women started to demand political citizenship and the right to take education and the right to participate in society. So you had all these movement initiated partly by the occurrence of this group of single women, and also single women were very much in promoting the first wave feminism, and a lot of single women were very active in the feminist organizations of the 1880s and the 1890s, and many of the reforms in regard to legislation and opening up of education and those kinds of things came as an effect of the need of these single women. So everyone saw that these single women needed to be able to support themselves. And this process set in movement a lot of changes in the field of gender. And also I've been looking really into the culture of these single women, what I call a spinster culture that developed in this year, that could be seen as part of a not an underground movement, definitely not, because these were middle class women that saw themselves as the core of civilization and respectability, and but still they were also seen as a societal threat, and they did develop their own culture that very much was in conflict with some of the traditional gender system and some of the traditional relationship between men and women and all that. And of course, I also look into the romantic friendships of the area and the homosexual relationship between women in that area. And then I claim that during the 1920s, the 1930s, Norway was heterosexualized. That's when heterosexuality as an ideology really came to Norway, and I also claim that the spinsters were marginalized in a new way during the 1920s and 1930s, when this sexual relationship between men and women were very much highlighted in the public culture and in popular culture.
How is the process of this de-heterosexualization, if it begins in the 1920s, how does it develop historically in Norway to a situation that is perhaps one of the most progressive in the world? Is there a queerization that takes place, and how does that happen, if that is something you're comfortable talking about?
Yeah. Well, it depends a little bit on where you look, but from the perspective of the single women, I would claim that in the kind of Victorian era, in the 1870s and 1890s, and that time period, not getting married was absolutely a problem. Women were supposed to marry, and women were supposed to have children, and the spinster did neither. So they were definitely a problem to the established gender structure. At the same time, it was also, the Victorian culture was also very much a society with separate spheres for men and women, a strong emphasis on gender difference and how women had certain characteristics and men other characteristics. And it was really acceptable for men and women to live kind of separate lives. So in that gender framing, it was possible to develop a culture, a women culture, where men were excluded and where women and femininity and feminine values, as they call them, got great attention. So these spinsters could live in a culture where they worked among other women. They were doctors, or they were nurses, or they were teachers. So they would spend their whole career among other women, doing good for society. And then during their spare time, they would either participate in women choirs or women missionary organizations or feminist organizations or all kinds of women-only activities. Mm-hmm. So it was possible to kind of develop this women-only sphere where many spinsters really had the possibility of creating lives full of dignity and all these kinds of things. And also, of course, since they were middle-class women, seeing themselves as representing the height of civilization, and they were also in some ways perceived as such by the society, they were representing what everyone in society saw as good values. They also could raise their voice in the public and have a legitimate place in the public in this period. And I also would claim that in this period, from 1880 to the First World War, really, it was the gender systems were kind of in flux. They were fluid, and there was a lot of debate. There were many different voices trying to define what the new genders should be about, what the new gender roles should be about, what the new gender system should be. So the group of spinsters were one of these voices in the period, trying to mold the new society and the new gender systems the way they thought they should be molded. But then after the First World War, a new belief in psychology, popular Freudianism was big in Norway, as was the theories of Wilhelm Reich, the German psychologist who lived in Oslo in that period, who strongly believed in the relationship between men and women and how sexual relations between men and women were really the core of of progress and a way to true liberation and to the communist society and all that. So, and the popular culture was much more frivolous, much more focused on sexual relations between men and women. So all the Victorian era and the Victorian ideals, focusing on separate spheres and all that, were really seen as really, really old-fashioned and not seen as progress in civilization more at all. And also, of course, since these spinsters that I've focused on was very much upper class and middle class. The growth of a socialist feminist movement also focused on very different agendas than the old bourgeois women's movement had focused on.
What are these new agendas that the socialist
The socialist women focused more on maternity, motherhood, contraception, abortion, issues that for the spinsters had been absolutely taboo. I mean, the spinsters were strongly opposed to contraception, strongly opposed to abortion, strongly opposed to education in sexual matters, and many of them argued that to give women contraception and give women the right to abortion would only enhance men's possibility of abusing and taking advantage of women's.
From the perspective of your research, do you see these spinsters as kind of foregrounding or no foremothers of a queer movement, or is that not a relevant analogy?
Yes, it is, but I don't think I see them as forerunners for a queer movement, but I do see them as queers in many ways. I do think it is interesting to look at the culture of the spinsters and the social discourse about spinsters and the categorization about around spinsters as kind of a queer space and queering going on. So I would claim that spinsters have been seen as queers in the time period I've been working on, but I also claim that the content of this queerness is something that shifts from spinsters being seen as queer because they were not mothers or wives, but first of all because they wanted to go into the public sphere and to kind of break the gender boundaries between the private and the public. So they wanted access to the public life, they wanted to be able to take offices, to be in politics, they wanted to have their own economy and all that. So I think in the Norwegian context, this is the most queer about spinsters in that time period, that they really wanted to break some fundamental gender roles. And they were seen as a threat to the established gender order because of this. So to me, that's the content of the queerness in the first phase of the spinster society. And then in the second phase of the spinster society, the queerness of the spinsters were much more linked to explicit sexuality or to the lack of sexuality, which became the main content of the spinster queerness. So since no decent women in the Victorian era were supposed to have sexuality, the spinster hadn't really been queer in that regard. But in the 1920s and 1930s, suddenly female sexuality was discovered, and suddenly all women were supposed to have sexuality, and frigidity and asexuality became a topic, and a very problematic topic. So from one generation of women to the next generation, you had gone from a view of all decent women being asexual or having very little sexuality, to the next generation where all women were supposed to have sexuality and to enjoy sexuality. So then the spinster became queer because they did not have or take part in sexual activities. And they also became queer because they were much stronger linked to homosexuality. So the romantic spinster friendships of the earlier phase that were not seen as problematic in a sexual way became highly problematic in the 1920s and 1930s. So suddenly all female relationships were seen as suspicious and were seen in a new sexual light that they had not been seen in 20 years. 30 years earlier.
Is there a parallel narrative between men around the time? That, in other words, could you speak of spinsters as male, or how was that narrative perceived if there was a group of people behaving similarly in male gender. Mm.
And I don't really think there was a male group behaving in the same way, because so much of this was linked to the changes in the women's role in the area, and men's roles were not as changed as women's role in that area. And male friendships had been more suspicious even earlier on. So male sexuality was present as a possibility also in male friendships earlier than they had been in women's relationships. So, and you'll probably also see when it comes to male homosexuality or homosexuality, you see more examples of explicit male homosexuality, and you see examples of more men than women identifying with homosexuality and the concept of homosexuality. So men became homosexuals before women became homosexuals in the Norwegian history. But of course, we don't have much sources on this, because there is not many that has written about this in their diaries, or and there is not that many court cases from the area. So I'm sure there will come more research on this time period, and then we will have more knowledge on how these things really were.
But both that male homosexuality at the time, and then in the second phase of the Spinters with a heightened sense of sexuality, were perceived as a threat for society?
Oh yes, absolutely. Mm.
How does this change? How in other words, how does a queer movement begin and start to evolve in a way that changes its perception for Norwegian society?
And maybe I should take back what I said, because I don't necessarily think. I think in the first phase, the spinsters were definitely seen as a threat. Mm-hmm. And when you look back at it, they definitely were a threat. Mm-hmm. They did challenge the existing gender norms, and they did create a whole new gender order in society with the first wave feminism. But in the second phase, in the 1920s and the 1930s, I don't think they were seen as a threat anymore. I think they were kind of outfaced. I don't know if that's a word, but... No, they were kind of defined as old-fashioned, as not significant, as pathetic, as pathological. They were frigid and maybe homosexuals, but they were kind of they were not seen as a threat because they didn't count anymore. It was other groups in society that started to count, and the bourgeois spinsters were a figure of the past, and they were not something you had to take into account anymore. The Second World War is kind of it marks two different periods in Norwegian history. So everything, the modern homosexual movement started around 1950 in Norway. And I don't know if you really can see any traces back in history to that movement. Probably you see more links between the modern homosexual movement starting around 1950 with other homosexual movements starting in the same time period in other Western countries. So you see parallels between what happened in Norway, as in the US, or of course in the other Nordic countries, especially Denmark, who was the leading Nordic country. Both women and men were involved in the start of this new organization in 1950-53, depending a bit on how you defined it. And they were a part of this homophile movement that started in the US. And as you know, homophile has become the word we use for homosexuals in the Norwegian language. So Norway is one of the few, maybe the only country in the world that's kind of stuck to this term that was introduced in the 1950s, a term that was supposed to sound better than the homosexual and the focus on sexuality and the concept of homosexuality. So you introduce the concept homophile instead, where feel means love. So instead of sexuality, you were supposed to focus on love. Of course, to make the concept more respectable and likable. And the queer or the homophile movement in Norway focused very much on respectability and trying to, they were very discreet, working in partly in secrecy for many years and working towards politicians and psychiatrists and trying to get contact and doing lobby work.
Can you explain to me because this is something you told me off camera yesterday, that the homophile movement was, and you just mentioned it again, based on respectability and family values. Could you give me the kind of traits or characteristics that you mean when you say this?
Yes. And I think in the first few decades, respectability was certainly very important. They were trying to change the view on homosexuality from, first of all, something that was illegal, and male homosexuality was still illegal in Norway until 1972. So that was one of the things the homosexual movement started to work on, to make male homosexuality legal. So to do that, they needed to clean the category of homosexuality and make it feel less criminal, less deviant, less pathological than it had been, to try to get sympathy for decriminalizing it, and that's what they did, and they tried to not make any fuss and to, of course, don't cross any gender boundaries or being explicitly sexual, so it was very much a focus on the individual's right to love whomever they wanted and to live in peace and live quiet lives in peace. So that was the official policy. In the first decades, it was certainly not focused on family values, but much more on the individual's right to live and love in peace. Then the 1970s came and a new radicalization of all social movements in Norway, also the homosexual one. But the grand old lady of the homosexual movement in Norway, Karen Kristine Friele, took over as the leader of the organization, I think in the late 1960s. And she became a driving force in the movement for several decades. And she was the first who publicly gave homosexuality a face and a name, and she was very vocal, and she came from a very respectable bourgeois family in Bergen, so she kind of had a right class background, the right language, she did a great job for the organization for many years. Then she continued the line where they worked towards individual politicians, trying to do lobby work, but also promoted homosexuality in the media and tried to give the public a picture of what homosexuality could mean and to give homosexuality a positive image in the public.
Is the term equality important then? Is it a word that is foundational to the movement in Norway?
But I think equality would be an important word, and to me it is interesting that that the movement in the early 1970s took a stand against marriage, that they underlined that they wanted they wanted individuals to have rights and equality, not couples. So they basically wanted to abolish couples' rights, like marriage, and to fight for the individual's right to a secure place in society. And as we know, this agenda has changed dramatically since exactly the focus on couplehood and marriage has become some of the main agendas for the later homosexual movement. But in the early 1970s, couplehood and marriage was definitely not on the agenda. Of course, also because at that time, that was probably too radical a vision. I mean, it was not possible to imagine that homosexuals would ever gain the right to marriage. So that might be also be one of the reasons for...
But if you're not recognized as an individual, you cannot be recognized at all.
Mm. But of course, also in the 1970s, it was much more focus on new life forms, new ways of living together, abolishing marriage, living in communes and living in polyamorous relationships, and those kinds of things were on the agenda to a larger extent in the 1970s than it has been in the 1980s and 1990s.
What is the relationship between the development of the welfare state and the movement? And are there parallels that are worthy of mentioning?
I think it's absolutely a strong link between the development and the gay movement. And certainly it has become a very strong link between the ideals of the welfare state and then the inclusion of homosexuals in as citizens, and to give homosexuals the same rights as everyone else in society. And the Labour Party, who has been the most important political party in Norway since the Second World War, since the 1930s really, has become one of the main proponents of homosexual rights, but within the Labour Party and definitely within the workers' unions, who has also been strongly linked to the Labour Party, there has also been strong opposition to this to putting homosexuality on the agenda. But in the last decade, at least, the Labour Party has been the main proponent of homosexual rights. But the Socialist Party, SV, is the party who has always raised the agenda of homosexuals first.
What does the welfare state as a social system offer that could become a healthy ground for the development of a movement such as the sexual movement or the queer movement, for example? If you compare it to a place in which there is no such a political and social platform.
Well, of course, the inclusion of as many citizens as possible into the productive welfare state is a goal for most. And so I think many of the legislative reforms in Norway has not been met with great opposition. Many of the reforms has come when the public was ready for these reforms, I think. So I think the wheel of the welfare state has kind of worked its way for homosexual rights. And of course, the movement has been really important, and it has worked really close with, in later years, in later decades, from around 1990, probably, has been working really closely with the political establishment, and has shared the agenda of the political establishment in wanting to include homosexuals on all levels of society, and to make homosexuals equal citizens. But I also think homosexual has become, and homosexual rights has become an important symbol for the welfare state, or for the modern welfare state, a symbol of progress and modernity, being one of the leading nations in the world. So it has also become a part of this nationalist discourse about Norway being a very modern, very progressive, inclusive and tolerant state, which has been become very much a part of the current nationalist discourse. So we're kind of the leading in matters of gender and sexuality.
And human rights.
And human rights. Mm.
Give me an idea of the phases of the situation of homosexuals in Norway. Say, from the time that you have been researching with the Spinters during perhaps in the wars and the modern movement, how have things evolved? Because we speak of Norway as, or we consider Norway to be the most progressive place, but I would like to understand, what is this kind of arch? Where does it begin and where is it now? And what is the challenge? What is the, now that the law is so much in terms of equal in many ways, what is the challenge now? And if you could draw the rainbow from one end of the spectrum to the other one, what happened in between?
I don't know if I would know where to start that rainbow. The story of the modern homosexual movement starts around 1950. But of course you could draw the rainbow back both to my romantic friendships of the spinsters, or to the sexual underground cultures of male homosexuals. So I'm not sure where the rainbow of the Norwegian lesbian and gay movement really starts, but if I let it start around 1950s, then the two first decades were focused on decriminalization, or the first big victory was when the law making male homosexuality illegal was removed in 1972. So that was the big, important victory of the first decades of the movement. And then, of course, you have seen a revolution in regard to visibility of homosexuality. And I'm sure Karen Christine Friele should have some of, or a lot of the honor for that visibility. So while homosexuality was not even mentioned the concept of homosexuality was not even mentioned in respectable newspapers in the 1950s and 1960s, suddenly in the 1970s, you started to have public debates about homosexuality. You saw homosexual faces on TV, or you heard them in the radio. You started to have demonstrations. You started to have homosexual sections in the 1st of May parades and things like that. Maybe that was later. But so just the visibility of homosexuality in public life increased immensely. And of course, while the homosexuals of the 1950s and 1960s had relied very much on secrecy and on keeping a low profile, the new agenda of the 1970s was to be out and proud and to make yourself visible and to tell everyone that you were homosexual and all
which
that.
Which is an international thing as well.
Absolutely. And the modern homosexual movement in Norway is definitely part of an international lesbian and gay movement. So you can see the same development in the Norwegian movement, I think, as many other Western countries. Of course, lesbians and gays traveled a lot, and they bought books in the U.S., and they traveled to the U.K., and they traveled to Copenhagen to go out to bars and go out dancing. They had lovers from different countries, and so definitely the lesbian and gay movement has been a very international movement with a lot of international contacts. What maybe is specific for Norway or Scandinavia is the, and it probably also has something to do with the size of the countries, that it has been possible to establish very strong contacts in the political establishment and to use lobbying as one of the main political or main channels for the work. And then after this period of focusing on visibility and gaining individual rights and anti anti-discrimination, the work for partnership or marriage rights started in the late 1980s. And that has basically been the focus since the late 1980s, a very strong focus on the right to couplehood. And I guess you can see that in many different ways. You could, in one way, you could see it as a reflection of the political climate of these decades, that to focus on family values, respectability, homosexuals being as good citizens, as respectable citizens, as family-oriented citizens as other, has been a very strategic and wise way of framing the cause. What has been interesting is that the critique of the nuclear family, the critique of marriage, those kind of debates that were present in the 1970s, disappeared from the public agenda in the 1990s and in the 2000s. So it has been very few opposing voices in the public. And maybe that is because, although many of us have been critical to the family orientation and the respectability orientation of the Norwegian movement, many of us still agrees that to gain marriage rights has been an important step in the gaining of citizenship rights. And when we got the gender equal marriage in 2009, that was kind of the final victory in regard to gaining full citizenship rights as queers in Norway. So despite the fact that many of us wants to abolish marriage, you can still see that the right to marriage has been an important step in the queer agenda.
So you speak of a final step, but what are the challenges faced by the queer community? Is there, if the legislation is so advanced and progressive, is there something cultural that is not the same way? Is there homophobia out culturally in families? Maybe this could also lead us into your current or recent research on suicide and the perception. What are those challenges that are faced that here today?
Some of the challenges are, of course, that although homosexuality has become equal in Norwegian legislation and has also been protected by anti-discrimination and all that, culturally, homosexuality is still definitely seen as something less than heterosexuality. The good life in Norway, what every parent wants for their children, the best life you can get, is still very much the heterosexual life. So although you can compensate for this, and as a homosexual, you still can gain those that good life by having children, by marrying, by living in harmony in your nuclear family. What I think most Norwegians see as the good life does imply a heterosexual life. And the project I've been doing on homosexuality and suicide narratives, there I've interviewed young people who have tried to commit suicide because of their homosexuality. And the stories they tell are stories about homosexuality being marginalized from a very young age. From a very young age, they did recognize that homosexuality was marginalized and was seen as something not only different from the lives their parents and family and friends and community lived, not only different from that, but as something fundamentally different, something that really belonged in a different reality or a different universe, something that went on a different place between different people and definitely not here in our family, at our school or in our village. So these stories I've heard tell about young people from the age of 14 to 18, living in a very heterosexual environment, getting very few positive stories about homosexuality, getting a lot of strong stories about how the good life is supposed to be a heterosexual life, and how they felt that if they were to become homosexuals, they would have to leave the life they had led until now, and they had to become different persons, both in the eyes of their families and friends and community, and maybe also in the eyes of themselves. So the fundamentality of homosexuality still being seen as the truth about the human being, as the and as you know, we use the word legning in Norwegian. So we talk about a homophile legning, a homosexual inclination, which I see as a very essentialist framing of sexuality. And that is the kind of term that is very much used in the public debate, homophile legning, and it's also something that is very much used in general conversations among people. You will be asked, it will be assumed that if you are a homosexual, you have this inborn inclination, the core of yourself is you're born a homosexual and there is nothing you can do about it, and this whole it's not a choice, it's something you're born to. It's a very strong story in the Norwegian context. So I think some of the problems that also the lesbian and gay movement has been part of creating is that in order to gain the citizenship rights and in order to give homosexuals more space in the public and to give us the right to live as ordinary citizens, there has also been a discourse focusing on homosexuality as an essence. So an essentialist agenda has very much been promoted, and also a strong focus on the sufferings of homosexuals. So the suicide narrative has been very strong in the Norwegian public, particularly since this report from 1999 came out that showed a higher occurrence of suicide attempts among young homosexuals. And those numbers, statistical numbers, has been used heavily by the homosexual organization to claim rights and all that. So to me, I think the focus on inborn identities, essentialist understandings of homosexuality as a fundamental difference, the focus on suffering and the cry for tolerance from the heterosexual society has been, on one way, it has been the root that has led to a lot of citizenship rights, and I don't think the Norwegian society would have been ready for anything else. On the other hand, I think it's a very problematic discourse and narrative that today, when we have gained all the citizenship rights, still are holding homosexuals down as something fundamentally different, as something that should be tolerated and felt sorry for. So I think in different cultures in Norway, homosexuality is definitely still seen as something less than heterosexuality and something you wouldn't really want for your children.
Does that speak of a kind of split in terms of the advancement of legislation and the promotion of an educational agenda in schools and culture? I mean, what is the relationship between those two things? Mm. Because I have seen often that they are two separate, for example, in regards to immigration in Sweden, which is something I know a little bit. The difference between the law and culture is just so dramatic that it speaks of a lack of education. Mm. Is that the case in Norway?
Yes, so it's partly about education, both on in the children's schools and also in teacher schools and nursing schools and on higher levels of education. But of course, it's also a development that has been quite rapid. I mean, it's not that long ago, since 1972, when homosexuality was still illegal. So I don't think it's surprising, really, that the cultural norms, the cultural norms about homosexuality has changed dramatically. They have not changed completely, but still, there is a lot more acceptance of homosexuality today than it was 30, 40 years ago. It's definitely a lot easier to live all kinds of homosexual lives in Norway than it was 40 years ago. It's a lot less traumatic for many youngs to tell their parents about their homosexuality. So things have definitely changed, but the norm is still heterosexuality. Heteronormativity is still the frame of reference for the Norwegian culture.
Are you critical of the suffering narrative that is created for homosexuals, or you consider that to be a foundational narrative yourself?
I'm critical of the suffering narrative. I think it's a very problematic narrative, and I understand why it has been used strategically by the homosexual organizations, but I do
Could
think
you just
it's
briefly a, say why, so that
yes, because I think when you look into debates on homosexuality and other moral issues in the parliament, for example, research shows that the arguments that most easily convince the politicians are narratives of suffering, narratives of nature. Nature is a very strong argument in the parliament. So I think, and also this story about homosexuality is as not a choice, but this inborn disposition. I think that has definitely been the only way of convincing politicians to let homosexuals have rights. So I think it has been a very successful and probably also necessary strategy to use.
So you're critical of it?
But I'm critical of it because I think that, especially by continuing to use this suffering narrative, you also reproduce homosexuality as second rate, as something less than heterosexuality, as someone that should be pitied and tolerated, and not seen as equal citizens. And in 2008, this award was given to a conservative philosopher called Nina Karen Monsen. So an organization called Free Word that gives a prize every year to someone who has been really brave and in a public debate, they gave their prize of 2008 to this conservative philosopher who has been very aggressively attacking all kinds of homosexual rights and who has been one of the strong opponents against the gender-neutral marriage law. And I think the public debate around this prize has been really interesting and really scary too. Nina Karen Monsen got a lot of support in the public debate from people you would not expect to support such an anti-homosexual agenda. And the scary part was that many of these straight journalists or a few academics who took part in this debate, they didn't recognize the agenda as anti-homosexual. And it was obvious that many of them had thought silently to themselves that they were really tired of all this talk about homosexuality, and they felt that homosexuals had far too many rights, and that we should now we should focus on the heterosexuals instead of the homosexuals. And it was kind of scary to see how many of those voices suddenly popped up when Nina Karen Monsen, in her lunatic way, had expressed some of these views. So I think for many of us, 2008 felt like a little backlash year in regard to homosexuality being set on the public agenda, because it became obvious that it's not politically correct to speak up against homosexual rights, but when this suddenly gave an outlet, it was clear that a lot of people had things to say,
right.
And that they were really tired of homosexuals taking up so much space in the public.
Returning a bit to your research on suicide, could you share with me, maybe if we could begin with the statistics, like is it so that homosexuals suicide more than others, and in what numbers, and what leads to this suicide? Is it a family pressure, or is it feelings of isolation in school and workplace and so on?
Well, you ask about the numbers of suicide attempts among homosexuals, and that is a problematic question because I feel that we don't have good enough data on that. But there are, all research implies that there is more homosexual youth committing suicide attempts than heterosexual youth. Exactly how much bigger this percentage is, I don't know, and I don't really think we can tell from the research, but there is an overrepresentation. In the stories I have in my book, like you said, feelings of isolation, feelings of being excluded from the environment you grew up in and still wanted to be a part of, is named as some of the reasons why they felt they couldn't, would rather die than live their lives as homosexuals. Of course, the suicide narrative is quite strong in homosexual history, and in Norwegian history it is quite strong. And of course, this is also a reproducing narrative, when that is the narrative about homosexuality that young people hear. They will also put their own suffering and their own struggle into that narrative and connect to that narrative in a way that potentially could be dangerous. But again, I think this feeling of the total isolation, the feeling of being so fundamentally different, something so something that cannot be integrated with a normal life. All the people I have interviewed wants to be normal and wants to have normal lives. And for them, homosexuality was not something that could be integrated into a normal life, or not something that could combined with a normal life. Homosexuality for them was something extraordinary and something that needed to take part in a different life than the life they had. So just the feeling of having to be someone different and living a different life and being someone extraordinary when all they wanted to be was something ordinary, I think was something that was really strong in the stories I heard. When I got the stories from my book, I had put an ad in the Lesbian and Gay newspaper, and people contacted me and telling me that they wanted to tell their stories. That was how I got most of my informants. I'm sure that there are a lot of other stories about homosexuality and suicide too, but the stories I got was kind of the classic homosexuality suicide script or narrative. So it's a quite standardized narrative about homosexuality as an inborn disposition, as something that was discovered in adolescent years, and then coming out and struggling, and then finding peace with homosexuality. So it's kind of a classic modern homosexuality script that is also very easy to combine with this suicidal script. Those two stories kind of are quite close together. So I think the story of the modern homosexual is also a story about suicide, and those two stories has been so closely linked for so long that it's very easy to put your own suffering and struggles into that script.
What do you think is the challenge for this youth, for example? Or how can you challenge this idea of what is the ordinary versus the extraordinary, mm-hmm. or the normalcy of society? Mm-hmm. I mean, how can we start living differently? I mean, within this paradisial mm-hmm. spectrum of legislation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what is important in the Norwegian context is that we need a bigger variety of homosexual scripts. We need different narratives about sexuality and homosexuality. We need to get rid of this inborn disposition, homosexuality as not a choice story, as the only story. Of course, it still will be a story, and it will be many individuals' story that they feel is what represents them, but we need to get other stories as well that don't have the same focus on inbornness and suffering and those kinds of stories. And we need to get the other stories out in the public too, and we definitely need to stop the begging for tolerance and acceptance. We need to take a much tougher line with the authorities, or we need to stop begging for tolerance.